It would be fair to say I operated in the zone with minimal supervision. The deputy DMAC and my closest superior, Major General John H. Cushman, worked out of Four Corps headquarters in Canto, 75 kilometers away. Since I'd never liked being too near the flagpole anyway, this suited me just fine, and I gradually slipped into the habit of doing whatever I wanted, or whatever I felt needed to be done. After a while, for example, I noticed that while the guys on the team who came from airborne or special forces were strack in their tailored camouflage gear, the rest of the men looked like GP medium tents in their regulation baggy-ass OD uniforms. They looked terrible, and I got the feeling they knew they looked terrible. So I decided everyone would wear camouflage gear. It didn't matter if a guy wasn't airborne or SF. I knew that once he was suited up as if he were, he'd feel he was, and that was the object. I had to do a little wheeling and dealing with old friends in the Viet Airborne Division to get the uniforms. The path was cleared by a small cache of SKS rifles we had stashed, but before too long everybody on the team was strutting with a couple of fine-looking cut-down parachute uniforms of their own. It would have been a happily ever-after story, except that on one of General Cushman's visits to the compound, he mentioned that a hell of a lot more of my men were wearing parachute uniforms than the team had airborne slots. I explained to him how the uniforms had been part of the deal I'd had to make with studs like Hancock and Menjivar to get them to come to the zone, and as for the rest of the men, well, sir, it just kind of happened. Cushman said he understood, but that there were Army regulations to consider, and bearing them in mind, he wanted those uniforms off all non-airborne personnel immediately. "I can't do that, sir," I said. "I told the men they could wear them. They've spent their money cutting them down, and they take a lot of pride in those uniforms, so if you insist on this, I'll have no recourse but to request relief." It was only a partial bluff. I didn't want to quit the zone, but I had to stand in the door. If I gave in, I'd lose so much face in my command, it'd be even worse than quitting. Cushman immediately suggested a compromise. From that moment, as my old people rotated home, their replacements would go back to Army-issued olive drab, and within a certain number of weeks, everybody else, less airborne, would return to OD too. I agreed in principle. But after the general went away, I formulated what ended up being a much better arrangement. After the deadline, when everyone was supposed to be phased back into leg jungle fatigues, the team rule was you could wear your camouflage uniform wherever and whenever you wanted, except if you went to Canto. Then non-airborne guys had to wear their regulation baggy-ass fatigues. If anyone wearing his parachute uniform accidentally ran into General Cushman outside of Canto, the rule was to play it cool, escape, and evade. We soon learned that in this situation, in public, Cushman's tack was to actively ignore the evidence of the breached regulation anyway. But if the general came to the compound, it had to appear as if we were playing by his rules. Fortunately for all concerned, it was SOP for all inbound helicopters to request permission to land on our pad, so we always had warning of Cushman's impending arrival. As such, when the TOC dispatched a jeep to pick him up, simultaneously they activated the compound's ground attack siren. The camouflage fatigue-clad team knew the alarm screaming in the middle of the day did not indicate a VC attack. Instead, it was their signal to drop whatever they were doing and change into their OD outfits. The guard at the front gate even had his regulation uniform hanging up in his guard box to slip into in time to salute Cushman as he drove up to the compound some 10 minutes after the first warning his chopper was inbound. General Cushman and I hit another snag in our relations when I decided to change the name of the compound. When I first arrived, it was called something like the Major Orville C. Snodgrass Compound. I logically asked who this fellow of the unfortunate name was, and was told he'd been a military intelligence major or something, who, just as the zone was being established, was standing in the middle of the compound in broad daylight when a Viet Cong 82mm mortar round slammed in and blew him to pieces. Since he was the first guy killed in the zone, the place was named after him. "Well, that's just not going to do," I said. We aren't going to have this compound named after some dead wimp. We're going to name it after a live hero, and promptly dubbed my new home the John P. Geraci Compound. This met with unanimous approval from the Airborne Ranger Mafia, who all knew and admired Geraci as a great warrior, and it was no less appropriate in that Geraci had been the Zone's first senior advisor. We made a beautiful sign in Ranger colors, also in Geraci's honor, and hoisted it up on the arch at the front gate where Major Snodgrass's memorial had previously resided. Cushman noticed it on his next visit the very minute he drove through the gate. "What is that sign?" he asked me. "John P. Geraci Compound, sir," I replied. "It's the new name of the compound." "Who authorized it?" "I did, General." "You didn't go through the Department of Heraldry?" "No, sir." "Hackworth, you can't do that, and you know you can't do that, and I want that sign changed back right now." A few words about General Cushman. He was an energetic, even overzealous man, a very articulate, intelligent academic philosopher type, and a West Point engineer. He was also an instant Army aviator, the latest punch on the old ticket for senior officers ever since Chief of Staff Westmoreland went through ridiculously abbreviated flight training and qualified, and well lived up to the warning my predecessor, Special Forces Colonel Bob Hassinger, had given me about him. If his motor's not running, his mouth is. Cushman struck me as very much the same type of soldier as William Childs Westmoreland. Hard-charging and ambitious, super straight and without one streetwise bone in his body. A cheerleader for the war effort. And since he didn't understand the Viets, or so it seemed to me, or recognize their total exhaustion with the war or their endemic corruption, through it all he was able to maintain his super-optimistic views. Cushman was as conventional in his thinking as 99% of the U.S. generals in Vietnam, and while he, like Westy, may have been a great commander in a conventional war somewhere, he didn't have a clue when it came to the present guerrilla battlefield. Generally speaking, I had to admit his ignorance worked in my favor. Except for his once-a-month visits, when he came around full of praise for my guys and for everything we were doing, he used Team 50 as an example to get his other three division-level advisory teams cracking. Cushman generally left us alone as, little by little, my men turned the screws and got the Viets producing. But Cushman was mad as hell about that sign, and he left me no room to maneuver. I wasn't going to quit over it, and this time he was the one standing in the door. So I took the sign down. Still, I thought it was a raw deal, and so did my boys. So after discussing it, we decided we'd just have two signs, Geraci for general purposes and Snodgrass for general purposes. The only person at all inconvenienced by this was the guy on guard at the front gate. Now, when he heard the ground attack siren announcing Cushman's arrival, not only did he have to change his uniform, but he also had to set up and climb the long ladder we permanently stationed behind the guard position for this contingency, change the sign, climb down, put the ladder away, and be the very model of smiling military precision when the general drove through the front gate a few minutes later. We got away with that one. But there was always something else I'd come up with that Cushman would lock my heels together and counsel me about. Often he got so pissed off he'd just yell. Like the time he got word that I'd told my guard at the front gate to shoot two U.S. Navy guys who'd come to the compound to retrieve their cement mixer if they moved the machine so much as 1 inch outside the compound. I mean, we found it, we dragged it back, we repaired it and paid for it out of our own pockets. As far as I was concerned, the only way the Navy was going to get that cement mixer back was if I hooked it under a chopper, dropped it from 5,000 feet over the exact spot we found it, and they picked it up from where they abandoned it. Unless, of course, they came up with something great to swap for it, like a battleship. I explained all this to General Cushman, but he was unimpressed and launched into what had become a familiar tirade. "Hackworth, let me remind you that you are a member of the United States Army. You are not down here with your own separate army. You do not make the rules. You are not the law. You belong to a higher command, and you are responsible and reportable to that command. Do you understand me?" "Roger, sir," I'd responded, as I usually responded. "I'm sorry, I must have gotten carried away." In the case of the cement mixer, however, I did add that the Navy would take it over my dead body, and they never did get it as long as I was in the zone. So, as far as Cushman went, I generally ended up doing exactly what I'd planned to do anyway. And though the general sometimes got mad, he usually looked the other way, because in the final analysis, he was interested in only one thing, results, and Team 50 was giving him results. So when it all shook out, General Cushman was wrong about me and my command. I did have my own separate army in the zone, and I was the law. It would be untrue to say that I wasn't myself in my last command, but I was not the man I'd been 9 years before when Colonel Johns led the vanguards into Berlin, or even 5 years before when Tim's traveling trouble began its whistle-stop tour of battle areas all around South Vietnam. I was 40 years old, and I'd suddenly realized that the Army, this rotten whore I'd been madly in love with for the last 25 years, wasn't going to mend her ways. It was as if I knew that no matter what I did or what I said, I was always going to find her cheating, find somebody else in our bed, as it were. And while in the past I'd always swallowed the disappointment and the hurt and backed away, saying, "Sorry, honey, I'll come back in an hour," thinking that everything would be okay then, in the zone it occurred to me that maybe I was wasting my time. "The Army isn't what it used to be," I lamented to General Cushman one day. "It never was," he replied. I didn't want to admit it, but I knew he was right. After all, Once an Eagle, that extraordinary, epic Army novel, had recently been published, and in it author Anton Meyerer had well expressed how the hunts of the Army world, the callous career-first ticket punchers, exemplified in the butchering character of Courtney Massengale, had been gliding past the Geraces and Hayeses and Johnses, in Meyerer's world epitomized in the character of decent warrior Sam Damon, for generations, and always would. So it was just unfortunate that I, who'd set my sights on being a buck sergeant in the marvelous Trieste days that molded me as a soldier and began my love affair with the Army, had somehow never gotten the word. In mid-November, Brigadier General Jack Hemingway, my battalion commander from the 223rd in Korea, now CG of the Aviation Brigade, flew into the zone to say that the War College list had just been announced and my name was on it. Because I'd deferred the previous 2 years, the news wasn't a surprise, but it was wonderful to see General Hemingway again, and I appreciated his hearty congratulations. I didn't have the courage to tell him I wasn't going to attend, however. Other than Ward Just and Jenny Bates, the first to know that were the Army personnel managers, to whom I wrote as soon as I got the official word. Request that I be removed from the senior service school list permanently. My reason for this is I have no aspiration to be a general officer, and I have no desire to work in positions where this education is required. Hence, it would be selfish of me to use a much sought-after quota when more ambitious types are available. Or, as I wrote less loftily to Jim Mitchell, my buddy from the Two Corps days, have no aspirations to be a general because I have known only a few good ones, and besides, I would have to buy new uniforms and become a phony. Want to be a bird who doesn't give a fuck and who everyone is afraid of because his shit is straight and he cannot be intimidated because he doesn't care. Effectively, I was ending my career. I knew I'd soon be promoted to full colonel, and without a star to aspire to from there, and no war college meant no stars for sure, I had nowhere to go. But, as I wrote to Jenny Bates, I no longer have a burning dedication towards the Army, or for that matter, America as it exists today, so I refuse to serve it just because of the attainments which appear to be certain. I was glad I was going to make Byrd. The prestige and retirement pay were better. But now that the decision to quit had sneaked up on me and been made, I had to rethink some plans. My first decision was, after the zone, to get myself a non-troop fat cat Army job outside of the United States to ride out the mandatory 2 years service the promotion cost me. My second decision after that was to just fade away. There was a tremendous amount of heartbreak involved in all this, I felt the army had failed me, and through this ineptitude it had inexcusably failed the nation every American soldier was tasked to defend, that nation being the United States of America, not South Vietnam. And 20 years after Korea, I now understood the anger of Bill Smith's father over the death of his raider son. Back then, I'd condemned him for not understanding there was a price of admission to the American way, a price the immigrant Mayamuras had borne without complaint. But now I could see, through the Vietnam debacle, that while there was a price to be paid, it was only correct to pay it if the product, democracy, was sound. And it was not sound in the corrupt ranks of South Vietnam's government and military, nor had it ever been, nor would it ever be, regardless of how many of America's sons threw their lives into the pot. As a nation, we had to get out of there. I'd always been one to speak my mind, but my hurt during this period, added to the fact that I knew I was getting out, made me too frank, too candid about how the war and Vietnamization were going. Old friends like Joe Love would attend briefings I was tasked to give and later comment to me about my cynicism. After a while, I was not asked to do such briefings anymore. The endless stream of visitors who'd characterized my previous tours, who came to me for the straight skinny on the war, dried up. It was not because I was getting out, no one knew, but because of my attitude, as a reliable source put it, which had potential guests being dissuaded from visiting the zone. The word was, I was a little battle-rattled, and maybe I was, I'd never know. All I knew was that Barney K. Neal had been killed at Pleiku on 11 September of that year, 1970, bringing home probably more painfully than any of the other drops on the stone of my consciousness, the terrible, wrongful waste of it all. In any event, we in the zone were effectively cut off from making positive comment to correct the ills that beset the system. My recourse was in my writing, articles that were more and more truthful, and consequently more and more abrasive, yet which continued to be published in military publications, and my press friends, most of whom I'd met and played poker with at the Pleiku press camp when I was at Two Corps. These guys gladly accepted my leaks and non-attributable statements, which assisted them in telling the truth of the Vietnamization farce. Meanwhile, in my command, I gave in to the urge to hurt my too well-loved whore as badly as she'd hurt me. First and foremost, my aim was to make her look foolish. Consequently, while I'd never been one for regulations, as time passed in the zone, I went out of my way to break every one I could. I took immense joy in screwing the system, joy that was only matched by the fact that in the process my men had some of the best damn times of their lives. Every day I sent one of my bird dog reconnaissance aircraft to Saigon to get the latest movie for my troops to see that night, or to bring in steaks for the outdoor snack bar. Experience had shown me the Viets didn't exactly pounce on the intelligence such planes provided, so I knew one aircraft would never be missed. Through our unauthorized fund, we kept a safe house in Saigon and installed Frenchie Fry there, designating him Team 50's unauthorized liaison officer at MACV. His principal job was to cut through the mountains of red tape that accompanied all promotions, awards, orders, and getting good replacements for the team. Often, all this required was giving just the right little souvenir to just the right person, and Frenchie quickly proved a master at knowing which button to push. VC weapons were always in, but the best bribe these days was the Vietnamese jump badge, which had to be authorized by the Viets. Every glory-hungry desk jockey wanted to wear that one, and Frenchie had an inside line into getting them on short notice. Fry was also in charge of all major scrounging efforts, although he preferred to call it relocating government property in Saigon, and as required could even switch gears to play Mother Hen to follow team members when they visited the big city on their in-country R&Rs. Every day we had morning and evening briefings. The war and my responsibilities as a Vietnamizing senior advisor didn't stop just because my heart was broken. To allocate and coordinate assets, organize and follow up on operations, thrash out what was being done right and wrong, and how and what things could be improved, etc. Though these were always damned effective working sessions, that did not mean that they had to be deadly serious. For one thing, I insisted that all participants feel free to question and to challenge me, to think rather than yes-sirring their way into my good books. This brought new vitality to the proceedings and fresh ideas to our operations, not to mention keeping me on my toes. In the almost quarter of a century since my stern disciplinarian days as a trust corporal, my command style had evolved significantly. Now it was closer than anything to the Israeli way of doing things. I was still the boss and the final decisions were mine, and everyone knew it, but all in all, there was less emphasis on the Mickey Mouse, more on listening to subordinates and being open to good recommendations. We adopted as our briefing battle cry, "Fuck Ho Chi Minh," who was dead by now, but what the hell, which was sung out in unison and kept us mission-oriented. I also implemented a word and thought for the day program to open each morning's proceedings. The program was run by Captain Howard E. Cecil, our erudite G2 advisor and resident military history whiz. The word for the day could be any word in the world, and the thought from anyone living or dead. My own favorite word for the day was telesis, which was defined at the briefing as to make progress, because it appeared again a few days later in the morning's thought. To the South Vietnamese, the Joker explained, telesis is a disease to be avoided like the plague. Right on, brother. Right on. Briefing officers were encouraged to let their hair down and have fun during the proceedings. They had to have their shit together. If they didn't, they knew I'd nail them. But as long as aviation LNO B.J. Jensen gave me an accurate report, I didn't mind if he appeared wearing his blue Black Hawk Civil War hat, or even better, his little cap with a propeller sticking out of the top, which he twirled around as he spoke. In fact, I encouraged it. I thought it was just fine if a briefer came out, as one did, with his hair parted in the middle and plastered down with Brill Cream, wearing granny glasses and a little red paper heart stuck on his uniform over his own heart. Anything to eliminate the routine in the routine. And the rule was, I was not allowed to crack even the slightest hint of a smile. This, of course, was a great motivator for the men, and from time to time they did catch me out with skits and costumes that were just hilarious. Once I got them all back, however, with a little act I cooked up with Captain Stephen Bates, our adjutant, who was the last briefer of the evening. While Bates gave his normal report, I sank down in the high-backed leather armchair I always sat in the front of the room for the briefings, so that none of the other guys, who all sat behind me, could see what I was doing. I put on a long-haired hippie wig that balding Frank Schutte's sister had sent him as a joke, and a spare pair of granny glasses. When I was ready, I gave Bates the signal to launch into our prearranged routine. "Sir, I've noticed that a number of the men are growing sideburns," he said. At this time in the Army, Chief of Staff Westmoreland's magic panacea for all the screwed-up and or angry draftees and the problems they caused across the board was to let these men have beer in the barracks, no KP, long hair, and sideburns. It didn't work, because while the Army got rid of the offending military traditions, it did not replace these traditions with anything that fulfilled their basic and essential function— that is, to instill and maintain discipline. Sure, the changes helped keep outright rebellion at bay in various quarters of the Army, but if the Army expected its men to be effective on the battlefield, even to stay alive on the battlefield, discipline had to be the number one priority. So Bates said some of the men were growing sideburns. "Yes, I know," I responded sharply, staying low in my seat and ranting in the best tradition of Captain Queeg. "And it's going to stop! Today I saw a man with an inch and a half of hair on the top of his head. I saw a man with hair on the sides of his head, and another man with hair on the back of his neck. These men will have white walls, nothing on the sides, nothing on the back, a half inch only on the top, airborne haircuts. Do you men understand?" There was no response behind me. "The old man's done it now," the silence screamed. "He's flipped right out of his head." "Do you men understand?" I bellowed and popped up over my chair to face them. The silence continued for another second as the men looked at my straggly wig and granny glasses in complete disbelief. Then they started to laugh. Bates and my trick brought down the house. It was a good way to end the day. About a week before Thanksgiving, the senior advisor to the 7th Arvin Division was fired, and Cushman selected me to go straighten out that unit. I didn't want to go. I'd worked hard in the zone, and I'd brought together a damn good team that I was very unhappy about leaving behind. And as I wrote to Ward about the move, I was really tired of troubleshooting. Haven't got the spirit because I know that I'll squeeze Arvin and he will shape up. Week after I leave, he's back to his old tricks. So why go through the frustration of squeezing the little bastard? But I couldn't refuse the assignment, because I hadn't told, nor did I want to tell, Cushman I was getting out of the Army. I felt if he or McCown knew I was quitting, they would think I'd no longer care about doing a good job, and be all over Team 50 like molasses. As it was, Cushman's once-a-month visits were almost too much. Thanksgiving came, and with it what I thought would be my last big bash with the men of Team 50. A proper dining-in in honor of Major General Bill Henderson, my Australian friend, now CG of the Australian Task Force in Vietnam, who had helped get me in hot water, albeit unintentionally, on my last day at the Pentagon. The dining-in was an 18th-century British battlefield invention. Historically, its purpose was to preserve the amenities of civilization and normality in circumstances far from civilized or normal, as our letter of instruction LOI for the proceedings explained. It always took place in the field, and its participants were all the officers of the regiment who came together expressly for this formal dinner, which began with drinks and ended with toasts to the reigning monarch. When I was at 2 Corps, I'd been invited to a dining-in at General Corcoran's 2 FFV mess in Nha Trang. The invitation had actually been engraved, with a 3-star flag at the top and writing in gold ink. I did not attend. For one thing, it had seemed incredible to me that such a waste of time and assets would be condoned, much less encouraged. In my case alone, it was a 200-kilometer chopper ride just to get to Nha Trang, and there were people coming from all over the place. For another, since the vast majority of the participants in this war sat at desk jobs and the like in the huge plush base camps, their circumstances were completely civilized and normal in the first place. The amenities of civilization and normality just part of the Vietnam tour package. To me, a dining in such circumstances was little more than a slightly regimented dinner party and a wasteful, completely self-indulgent exercise. My point of view had not changed on this subject in the zone, but when Henderson said he'd be visiting from Nui Dat at Thanksgiving, the dining-in concept seemed like a fun change for the team. Outsiders besides Henderson were not invited, and an appropriate tribute to a fine Aussie general. To put everyone in the spirit of things, Star Scrounger Hancock managed to acquire a dozen cases of VB, General Henderson's favorite Australian beer, and from the moment we cracked the first ones open upon Henderson's arrival, the somewhat irreverent Team 50 Thanksgiving dining-in was destined to be a great success. A few days later, just before I was to make the move to the 7th Division, my orders were canceled when I landed in the hospital with excruciating stomach pains. After a lot of puzzlement and a lot of tests, it was discovered one of my kidneys had an extra tube, and it had become blocked. That's what a dining-in will get you. It was not a serious affliction, and the flare-up could not have come at a more opportune time. Not only was I spared the transfer to the 7th Div, but I was out of the hospital and feeling fine in plenty of time for the highlights of the holiday season. The Christmas party Team 50 gave for the mostly Buddhist Viets who worked in the compound, our slush fund allowed for a 6-piece Viet band, tons of Vietnamese food, free drinks, a gift of $10 converted to piastre, at the best black market rate of exchange we could get, and a couple of cartons of cigarettes for each worker. And the first annual Rice Bowl football game, which was played on New Year's Day 1971. The action officers in charge of the Rice Bowl operation had magically transformed Tontic Airfield into a perfect 100-yard American football field, complete with plywood goalposts on each end, regulation markers, and umpires in black and white striped shirts. They'd also organized sideline activities, including hot dog stands and enthusiastic Vietnamese cheerleaders, our club girls in short little skirts. The two teams for the game were the Team 50 Studs and the 52nd Signal Battalion, a communications platoon of which was attached to us, Lightning Bolts. I had $300 riding on my studs. What the commo sergeant, whom I drunkenly made the bet with at the New Year's Eve party the night before, didn't know was that while his people were all high school amateurs from way back, I had a team of 11 football stars from various universities. The studs had it made in the shade. The game began. Surprisingly, the communicators made the first touchdown. Then they got the second, and the third. By the end of the first half, it was 21-0. We were getting our asses thumped, and the commo sergeant was singing. In a display of New Year's cheer, and with just a speck of guilt for stacking my team with ringers, I'd even spotted him 14 points. I couldn't understand it. I sought the advice of Frank Schutte, who'd been a great football player in his day. "I'll tell you what's wrong," he informed me. "You've got 11 stars out there. They all think they're in charge. I think you better go out there and tell them there can only be one quarterback. Because if all of them keep on showboating like they're doing, not only are they gonna lose, they are gonna have their asses wiped all over the field." I went over to the team. "Listen, boys, this shit's serious. Not only are we losing the game, but we're losing it to legs. We've gotta turn it around. Q," I turned to Captain Q for Quaywan Coley Stevens, "you're the quarterback. You call the plays. Everybody else, just listen and do what Q says. You follow? Okay. So let's get with it." And they did. In the second half, everything clicked. The signal guys never scored again. Not only did we win, but we beat them by something like 40 points. At the next night's hail and farewell, a dispatch was delivered to me from the zone message center. From the President of the United States to Senior Advisor Team 50. Subject, the Rice Bowl 1971. 1. S. The fantastic game played in the Rice Bowl totally outshattered other bowl games and made them look like the minors. I, as well as all of the American people, take great pride in saluting the courage, boldness, and skill of Captain Q's Studs and Stag's Bolts. 2. S. If you brave men in Vietnam will all just extend for 1 year, I and all the other Republican leaders will personally attend the next Rice Bowl game. Your admiring fan, Dickie Nixon. The dispatch, in the best Team 51 upsmanship tradition, was a great joke that had most of us going for a few minutes anyway, and while everyone had a good laugh over it, something in me knew that 1971 was going to be one hell of a year. And it was. First, Patty and the kids were programmed to come out to the Philippines through the Handclasp Senior Advisor Program, but as the time approached, I realized I couldn't deal with it and wrote her a letter telling her not to come. After all those years, however, she was not about to be dismissed with the letter and took the next plane over. And while we only got together once to organize a legal separation, her presence in the Philippines was brought to my attention on a regular basis by General Cushman, who, along with his Catholic wife, thought I was terrible for doing what I was doing to my Catholic wife. Once Cushman even called me into his office to tell me a divorce would jeopardize my career. I blew up and told him it was none of his damned business in the first place, and in the second, since when was there a block on the U.S. Army Officer Efficiency Report that measured how well a man and his wife got along? I wound up by saying I didn't recall the careers of Generals MacArthur, Ridgway, or Gavin being stunted by having been married 2 or 3 times, and not surprisingly, Cushman backed off. When excerpts from War Just's soon-to-be-released Military Men were published in the Atlantic Monthly, however, Cushman jumped right back on. Rumors were rife that I was the colonel of the second installment, and indeed I was. Ward had changed the physical characteristics and a few little details to keep the Army off course, but the outspoken, highly critical opinions expressed by the unnamed officer in the piece were still laid by some at my feet. and a shade more tarnish began to appear on the battle-weary golden-haired boy. At the end of January, finally, Colonel Hahn was relieved of command of the zone. His downfall ultimately came less as a result of the little book I kept on him than of Hahn's own abiding greed. When word got around that during an operation he had used 1,500 of his soldiers to drive 400 head of cattle from Cambodia to Canto for his own personal disposal, it was a bit much even by Vietnamese standards. This did not, however, prevent Hahn from later being promoted to brigadier general and given yet another command. The colonel was replaced by one General Hai, a graduate of Benning's career course and Leavenworth's CNGS, who, besides being a northerner Catholic, had absolutely nothing in common with his corrupt predecessor. Hai was a hard-working, no-nonsense, exacting man with a refreshing sense of purpose. He was hell-bent on winning the war. He was a damn good leader who set the example and demanded the total commitment of his subordinates. He respected the role of the advisor, so there was no game playing between us, a remarkable feat given that I was his 32nd advisor and he could have had every routine down cold, and he did not require bribery or coercion to get the job done. Hai was my kind of man, and as well as slipping right into an ideal commander-advisor hand-in-glove relationship, we quickly became good friends. Hai agreed with me that Arvin's problems were bordering on terminal, and that the key to winning was to be found in the regional and popular territorial forces. Together we implemented a program of territorial or mobile training teams, an idea I'd gotten from the Australians, using underworked personnel from my overstaffed HQ to train rough-puff units to provide reliable security at the hamlet-slash-village level. There seemed no question that the people could be won to our side if they knew they were really secure. Then they would not be afraid to ban the VC from their villages, an act that would deny the enemy recruits, food, intelligence, and support. Mao's fish would be without water, and their effort would, of necessity, dry up. Colonel Hahn had been totally against the concept, so until General Hai arrived, this kind of training in the zone had been virtually the one-man effort of Team 50's Captain Che Menjivar, whose real name was Milton, but the short, baby-faced, eternally insubordinate El Salvadoran by birth acted far more like the recently deceased revolutionary Guevara than some guy named Milton, so we changed it, who had gone from RF unit to RF unit teaching night ambush patrols with two Ranger NCOs. Under General Hai, now the mobile training team program was expanded to 5 teams, each consisting of an American captain, 2 NCOs, and a Viet interpreter, which were sent to the various districts for up to 3 weeks each to train the individual units therein. At the end of these training sessions, the teams would move on and let the Viet units fend for themselves rather than, as was standard procedure, continue to lean on their advisors to make things turn out right. That was the part Colonel Hahn hadn't liked, that we'd pull out and leave his units on their own. But, of course, that was the whole idea. The war would soon again belong to the Vietnamese, and after almost a decade of lip service about getting them to fight it, it was my intention in the zone, as it had been in the airborne, that that was exactly what they'd do, and do well. As Mao said, and as Team 50 picked up as its motto, "Give a man a fish, and he'll have one meal. Teach a man to fish, he can eat forever." Under General Hai, we also initiated an ambush academy to train rough-puff officers in this most effective tactic for fighting the guerrillas. We put tremendous emphasis on artillery training, too. The use of artillery, once the big stick of the South Vietnamese Army until U.S. helicopter gunships superseded it, had to be relearned by the Viets urgently as the wind-down of the U.S. effort slashed the number of American gunships available to the zone. The program was well worth the effort. With a lot of hard work, as well as spot inspection teams whose jobs were to swoop unexpectedly into fire bases and have a look at the individual guns and crews, after a few months, we were able to see marked improvement in the readiness and accuracy of the zone's artillery units, and in the confidence of the Viet infantry who had to depend on that artillery in a close support role. One area Hai was unable to make inroads in was the attitude and performance of our attached Vietnamese Air Force helicopter units, without a doubt the most dangerous collection of amateur flyers I'd ever seen, and only matched, I assumed, by 99% of the other VNAF units in the war. For myself, I'd reached the point of categorically refusing to fly in any Viet-maintained or flown aircraft. Among the final straws that led to this decision was a single moment one day when I was sitting in a VNAF chopper as the only American amidst a Vietnamese pilot and co-pilot, a Vietnamese crew chief and gunner, and General Hai and his all-Vietnamese staff. As we were about to get underway, the pilot, who'd been chatting away in Vietnamese to his passengers and crew, looked to his crew chief and said in English, "Coming hot." The crew chief responded, "All clear." When I heard that, I knew we were in serious trouble. The more mechanical become the weapons with which we fight, the less mechanical must be the spirit which controls them, Field Marshal Wavell wrote. Yet here were these Viets parroting like robots the words of their Fort Rucker, USA instructors, not relating to them enough even to translate them into their own language. While VNAF's striking limitations were well known to those whose operations and lives depended on them, it was only when General Tree of the Cambodian invasion was killed, along with, tragically, Newsweek's 24-year Indochina veteran journalist Francois Souli, in a characteristically neglected bird that burst into flames mid-air, that the cheerleaders for Vietnamization began to investigate and discover they had a problem on the air mobile side of things. Only then did they recognize that the Viets who'd been sent to America at America's expense for up to 32 weeks of helicopter training plus 6 weeks of instruction in the English language were coming back not with new levels of proficiency, but with vague concepts in disjointed English that they were unable to explain, much less perform, and that those tasked with maintenance felt that as long as the chopper logs, which they doctored daily as necessary, reflected the maintenance had taken place, that they'd done their jobs. Meanwhile, back at the 44th STZ, our Viet allies were stealing fuel and equipment from our Tan Tik and Mue Khoa staging fields at a remarkable rate. At Tan Tik alone, in 1 7-week period, enough fuel was stolen to sustain an entire aircav package of 13 choppers, a CNC plus 4 each of Slicks, Cobras, and Loaches, for 6 days of normal combat operations in the zone. The scroungers regularly stole flares and ammo as well. They also had a thing about ammo crates, which they generally took empty after uncrating the contents and leaving them, rockets, minigun ammo, whatever was going, scattered all over the airfield for the rains to destroy. This did little to foster goodwill between our men and the Vietnamese, and in fact, there was an increasing number of xenophobic incidents in the zone, where comments or criticisms, usually warranted but often snidely delivered by American personnel to Vietnamese, resulted in fistfights or weapon brandishings. And throughout this period, while my honeymoon with Hai continued, the quiet hope his arrival had brought faded away. We did everything in our power to get the Viet troops off their asses, but the bottom line was, they did not have the in-depth leadership to bring them up for the long-term game. The NCOs were tired and burned out. They'd seen far too much combat. The junior officers, lieutenants and captains, were just not motivated to win the war, and the majors, light colonels and colonels, their bosses, who should have provided that drive to win, served only as role models and inspiration for corruption. The only way to infuse Arvin with strong leadership immediately would have been by taking the top U.S. studs out of U.S. units or advisory jobs and giving them command of Arvin companies, battalions, regiments, and divisions. They, in turn, could have selected the best men based on ability, not connections, who would then OJT under the American officers until they got it right, at which point the Americans would go home. The process might have taken 4 to 6 years, so all the studs would have to be combat bums, that generic derogatory term generally used by the tourists to describe officers who copped out by volunteering for repeated tours in Vietnam, rather than returning to stateside duty and the multitudinous career-related activities that were expected of a modern Army officer. But that was all right. What we needed, what we'd always needed, to win this war were combat bums. Combat bums came in two main, albeit overlapping, varieties. Those who would have marched to the sound of guns wherever they were blazing, and or had become, as I had said, obsessed with figuring out a way to win this particular conflict, and or those who'd gone native. The natives were most easily identifiable. These were guys, many from special forces, who'd been there so long that the place had become a way of life for them. They loved the food, they spoke the language, many owned digs in Saigon or one of the other cities, and had Viet girlfriends to go home to when they weren't playing war. Most proudly wore bracelets that looked as if they were made of welding rods. Besides the occasional gold Buddha a guy wore around his neck, this was the one real outward display of combat bum status, and proudly signified nothing less than honorary membership in a Montagnard tribe. As a body, mostly by definition, the special forces in Vietnam were combat bums and the best guys to fight the G in this war. But the special forces were also animals, which offended all the prancers, and they considered themselves an elite force, which offended most everybody else. General Abrams hated them. Yet if these Green Berets had been allowed to run the show, there's little doubt in my mind that the outcome of the war would have been quite different. And volunteers would have queued up for the long-term command advisory jobs. The technique itself was a proven one, having worked time and again for the British in their Gurkha and other colonial units. Even at this stage, the plan here in Vietnam would have been well worth the effort. For my money, it was really the only viable option left. I truly believed that if Hai, a great, great general for the zone, in tandem with the even greater general, Corps C.G. Trong, could not turn Arvin's fortunes around in our area, then it just wasn't going to happen at all. This belief was only reinforced when President Nixon expanded the war yet again in February 1971 by launching Operation Lam Sun 719, an invasion into Laos designed to sever the Ho Chi Minh Trail. All the U.S. advisors were left behind, and besides some U.S. Special Forces pathfinders, this time it really was an all-Arvin show on the ground, using the very best troops in South Vietnam. And the Viets just blew it. They made a conventional attack, then immediately fell back on American air support to save their asses. And immediately we obliged, with aircraft brought in from throughout Vietnam, Thailand, and the Pacific. Nixon and company, while respecting their own rhetoric not to expand the ground war, had no hesitation about the use of air in as large quantities as possible. There is no limit, and we don't see any reason why there should be any limit on the use of that air power, declared Secretary of State William Rogers just before the Laotian operation began. Unfortunately, the NVA were well ready for the attack, with battle-ready troops backed up with tanks, anti-aircraft guns, and surface-to-air missiles. In the 2 months of fighting that followed, more than 100 U.S. helicopters were destroyed, and more than 600 hit, many badly, and 102 American air crews' lives taken. Again, the NVA proved willing to take terrific casualties themselves during Lam Sun 719, but they also took a hell of a lot of Arvin troops with them when they went. Arvin casualties were between 25 to 50% of the total troops involved, and in the end, despite U.S. fighter aircraft, choppers, gunships, artillery, and B-52 strikes, it was Arvin that scurried frantically across the border back into South Vietnam in undeniable defeat. Three cheers for Vietnamization. I'd met Jennifer Bates on my first R&R to Australia, which I'd taken with John Westmoreland just before I took over the zone. Jenny was a Deborah Carr lookalike, and I fell in love with her at breakfast the minute I saw her across the dining room at the Chevron Hotel on the Gold Coast. I didn't actually meet her until that evening, a meeting that began with a half-assed argument between us about the American involvement in Vietnam. British-born Jenny had seen her share of gung-ho Yankee soldiers in her job as a stewardess for Australia's Ansett Airlines, and I think she expected me to fit the mold. She was not a little surprised when our first fight quickly petered out, with me agreeing with almost everything she had to say. When I went back to Vietnam, we began to exchange letters. Soon we were getting together about once a month as well. thanks to the regular 3-day leaves I got as a senior advisor as part of the handclass program. Over time, Jenny also became an honorary member of Team 50, kind of playing the Frenchie Fry liaison role for my guys who took their R&Rs in Sydney, telling them where to eat, where the parties were, etc. And when her annual vacation came up in mid-March, I thought the least we could do was return all her favors and have her as our guest in the zone. As a British subject, Jenny was free to visit Vietnam at will and could simply fly into Tonsonut commercially. Ben Willis thought the idea was crazy and tried to dissuade me from going ahead with the plan. I told him I was the boss and I could do anything I damn well wanted to. Ben's voice of reason was often too much for me to take during this period of my rebellion, leading to many bitter fights between us. And I even organized for Judge Cooney's journalist wife, Catherine, to get accreditation from MACV so she could come over as a reporter during the same period, in case I ended up having to be away for 4 or 5 days on some big operation and Jenny would otherwise be left alone. Just before the visit, I was promoted to full colonel. It was a proud, proud day, and one made all the more special by Hank Emerson, now a brigadier general and commander of the Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg. Hank sent me a gift of the colonel's insignia he had worn until his promotion, the Silver Eagle, which, before that, had belonged to his father before he made general. What a good friend Hank was, writing me encouraging letters as my spirits flagged more and more, and trying again and again to turn my mind away from getting out. The team gave me a big, raucous promotion party, organized with love by old soldier and fine NCO Larry Portman. When it was all over and I was alone in my quarters, I marveled at the singular event that had made it all possible. Whatever its outcome, the Vietnam War had made me a colonel and paved the way for one or maybe 2 or 3 stars if I stayed in. Yet the Vietnam War, through what it had shown me, had destroyed my great love affair with the Army and made me decide to hang up my suit. Or had it, I wondered. The day I made colonel, the choice had never seemed so hard. Then Jenny arrived, and for 2 weeks I thought of nothing else. We were together every night, and during the days when we could be. She came along in the chopper when I went visiting individual units and border ranger camps, and well proved her mettle, too, not losing her cool even when one compound we were visiting came under mortar attack, or when we took a Special Forces airboat ride up the Mekong River and had sniper slugs snapping over our heads. She was the greatest morale booster my advisors out in the boonies could ever have dreamed of seeing, and the same had to be said for the guys at the Team 50 compound. Jenny and Catherine were the first round-eyed women most had seen in months, and the men hovered around them like lovesick kids. I couldn't blame them. I'd organized an R&R to Hong Kong to coincide with the end of Jenny's tour of the war zone. She flew commercial, and I met her there. We had a ball, even if I did spend a small fortune on uniforms for my next and last Army assignment, at NATO in Brussels as chief of the U.S. Army section. The job was a far cry from the first one DA offered me, a hush-hush Special Forces assignment in which I would have controlled all covert operations in northern Thailand. It was hard for me to believe I'd actually refused a hot SF job and held out to work in the make-believe world of NATO. But then again, a decade before, I never would have believed it if someone had told me I'd be checking out of the Army anyway but feet first. As soon as I got back from Hong Kong, Team 50 received its annual Inspector General IG inspection. The purpose of these inspections was to make sure everything was above board and conforming to Army regulations. Since the team was just one big broken reg, we had quite a bit of cleaning up to do to prepare. To be on the safe side, I organized for the IG and his team to be quartered with one of my subordinate units just down the road, rather than have them stay with us at Team 50. I shipped the few malcontents I had on the team off to distant outposts and put the rest of the men back in their OD fatigues. We folded up the outdoor snack bar and, for purposes of the inspection, deemed it a kitchen annex. We told Mr. Ko to give the steam and cream girls a few days off and made sure no Vietnamese went anywhere near the PX. We put all our hot vehicles, save one, in an area fenced off and guarded by a Viet, with the sign above it in Vietnamese so the IG would leave it alone, thinking it belonged to the Viet unit next door. The one hot Jeep we kept out was the one we gave the IG to drive around in throughout the visit. That was my own little joke to have a silent laugh over each morning when the IG pulled up to the compound. Most of the team knew the vehicle was hot, too, and when in the end we came through the inspection with flying colors and had the IG gushing with praise in his exit interview, one of his most favorable comments regarded the team's morale, citing the smiles that greeted him each morning when he drove through our gate in his Jeep. In January of 1971, an ABC journalist by the name of Howard Tuckner came to see me in the zone. He'd read War Just's Military Men, had heard I was the colonel, and now wanted to do a kind of television version of the chapter for his network. I told him to go home. In the first place, he struck me as a phony, and in the second, while his 8-part 10-minute segment series would be great for his career, it would certainly do little for mine. Even if I was going to quit, in the meantime, I still had 2 years NATO duty to go, and going on national television to tell the American people how badly we'd botched the war did not seem a particularly smart thing to do. But Tuckner was undeterred. I heard from him regularly in the subsequent months, months that saw the debacle in Laos, the disintegration of our own battlefield in the zone. Despite all of High's efforts, RF posts were being gobbled up at an alarming rate, and me finally saying enough to those MACV briefings that persuasively reported victory was at hand and left me feeling crazy because I knew what I saw on the ground was exactly the opposite. These events, coupled with Tuckner's doggedness, began to wear me down. We had bullshitted ourselves and the American people long enough, and it was too late for me to start playing the old go-along-to-get-along game just because it would serve me the best. So I began seriously to contemplate blowing the whistle in this most public of ways on national television. Whether or not to do the show became a number one concern for me. I probably asked my own advisors, Willis, Hancock, Frank Schutte, Ed Clark, Steve Bates, Jack Howitt, G3 advisor Doug Randles, and Judge Cooney every single day what they thought I should do. And while old soldier and NCO realist Schutte said not to touch it, my young idealistic officers were behind the thing 100%. There were truths that had to be told, they encouraged, but I remained tied up in knots inside. There were few things as taboo in the military as criticizing it outside the fold, and as I wrote to Jenny, I'd been in the Army so long I was like one of Pavlov's dogs. To speak out was against everything I'd been trained for. It was also against everything I'd believed in, against something I'd loved for so long and still did. After all, despite the times I'd felt the Army had failed me, it had also upheld me for most of my life. But what other avenue was left? I'd written memos and letters to my superiors, those generals who'd become friends, and articles for the Army at large on every germane issue I thought confronted the American fighting man and advisor in Vietnam. I'd convinced SLAM of the need for the Vietnam primer. We wrote it, and now 2 million copies were in print. I'd proved on the ground with the men of the 4th of the 39th how to fight the war on the cheap, in a way suitable for a protracted guerrilla conflict, which was the only hope for success. I'd talked to General Johnson, the Army Chief of Staff. I'd talked to Stanley Rezor, the Secretary of the Army. I'd contributed as honestly and pointedly as I could to that paper General Westmoreland requested in 1968 when he became Chief of Staff, on where the war had taken us and where we were to go from there. I'd talked to anyone who was anyone who came to visit my commands because I, they'd been told, was someone, until I got tired of standing there politely as I watched my words go in one ear and out the other of my guest and began to talk even more bluntly. I'd leaked information and stories to trusted pals in the press, thinking they could make a dent in the mindset of the Army hierarchy. In a word, I'd tried. But that fact didn't make the decision to go public any easier. Then two things happened, and the decision made itself. First was a promotion list that showed Ira Augustus Hunt Jr., already a one-star, on the 5% list to Major General. Second was the conclusion of the Cali trial, which had the recycled OCS lieutenant found guilty of premeditated murder, only to have President Nixon step in and declare that he would personally review the case. And while two events on one level had nothing in common, on another, to me, they said it all about what was happening to the Army. And inasmuch as I could possibly do something about it, I just couldn't let it go unremarked. In and of itself, the Cali case was a microcosm of everything that was wrong with the Army. I'd first learned the rumor about My Lai when I was in the Delta with the 4th of the 39th, and I'd strongly denied even the possibility of it having happened. I'd fought a lot of years as an infantryman and seen my share of what could be called atrocities, but never had I seen, nor could I ever imagine it occurring, American soldiers involved in such a massacre of women and children. In my experience, it just wasn't in the American soldier's mentality. Obviously, this was before I studied Sand Creek and other infamous moments in our Army's Indian fighting days. Nonetheless, when the truth came out, despite the determined effort of Cali's battalion, brigade, and division commanders to cover it up from the Army, and the Army's determined effort to cover it up from the press, what the facts revealed made the crime only too believable. My Lai reflected the horrific inadequacies in the training system, which, rather than coming to terms with the fact that attrition in the schools was a fact of life, pushed